Hello, everyone. This is Austin Peterson. Welcome to the Freedom Report podcast. Today actually is Sunday the 7th, and I'm debating whether I'm going to release this tonight or first thing tomorrow morning, which would be Monday the 8th. So if you're listening to this on Monday the 8th, just so you know, this was recorded on Sunday night at 7 p.m. And I wanted to talk to you all a little bit about The Fire and Fury, the new book that's been going around Washington, D.C. that has changed the political fortunes of so many people in such a short time. Specifically, I'd like to read to you from an article that was written by a good friend of mine, a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Tucker, who writes at the American Institute for Economic Research. And his article is titled Top Things I Learned from Fire and Fury. And it's a wonderful article, and it really makes me want to read the book because I was really surprised by Tucker's analysis of the book. And the reason why is because it seems, from at least from what Tucker is reporting to me here, that the book shows that the author is not just engaged in what we're seeing from the mainstream media, which is just a war of personalities, right? Is that the author of this book actually seems to understand the sort of ideological clashes that have been occurring inside the Trump White House, specifically the reason why so many people who were so critical of President Trump from beforehand may be saying nice things about him now, including myself, including the person who you're listening to right now. I'm the Republican Senate candidate in the state of Missouri who is running to unseat Claire McCaskill, the sitting Democrat. And of course, I'm competing in the Republican primary against the current Attorney General of Missouri, a gentleman by the name of Josh Hawley. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit as I read this. I'll go through this article. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how it sort of affects the dynamics of what it is that I'm doing and what's going on. Because, you know, unlike most politicians, rather than be the type of candidate who says as little as possible about the big important issues of the day in order to not alienate anyone, I'm going to be the anti-Josh Hawley in this race, and I'm going to talk about the issues that are important, that matter, and that may be controversial, even if it may potentially cost me some support, because I think in the long run, of course, political campaigns, not only should they be campaigns to win, but they should also be educational, a good opportunity to educate and inform the electorate. Why am I running, for example? Why am I running? Well, because of the issues that I care about. Not so much about the personality politics, but about the ideas. And what Jeffrey Tucker seems to have divined is that there is a real ideological struggle that's occurring, more than the sound bites that we're getting from CNN and MSNBC and many of these institutions that are, grabbing the biggest, most juicy, salacious, you know, the most salacious quotes from this book. But Tucker dives into the issues that I really care about, which are the sort of meta struggles, right? The meta debates that are happening right now inside the Trump White House. And but unfortunately, of course, in order to get into this, we have to get into someone's head, right? And we're going to get into a little bit inside of Trump's head and see sort of how he operates, why he operates, how he operates, and sort of divine the sort of mental positioning of the people who are, in power and now Bannon sort of out of power in a sense. But Jeffrey Tucker writes this. He says, the Trump administration is truly the impossible presidency. Donald was never supposed to win. He didn't believe he would win. When he did, he said he did something that absolutely no one could have predicted. He didn't become anything we have associated with being president ever. He refused to be anything but Trump. As a result, a century or two of protocols, rituals, pomps, decorum, and presidential serioso, the entire apparatus of governing as the head of the world's largest and most powerful state, are being dismantled. And think of it, it has barely begun. For this, he has earned his right to be a universal folk hero forever. He has shattered every illusion of power associated with the presidency, bringing near daily delight to multitudes around the world with his incessant bitter bragging and petty tweets. The whole thing is stunning. It certainly has defied my most pessimistic predictions of what this presidency would do. I had expected far more darkness and far less comedy. Now, this is Jeffrey Tucker writing, so when you see this is Jeffrey Tucker's words. My above impressions are heavily reinforced by a tremendously delightful book that I just finished. Finished, a book which might break all records for political bestsellers. I highly recommend Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff to get a sense of the man we are dealing with here. I don't want to minimize the dangers Trump represents. He would be so much more delightful if he had no power, and indeed, he is the best argument for limiting government there's ever been. But there are ways in which he is playing some kind of a pointed role in the unraveling of state power, or so we can hope. Jeffrey Tucker goes on. One feature of this book is rather overwhelming. It covers all the things that you remember happening, but the truth is that you had already forgotten 9/10 of them. This 1 year of a presidency has produced as much drama, most of it fake, but most of it is fascinating, as 20 years of a normal presidency, right? It's like whole seasons of Mad Men binged on fast forward and running daily. Near the end of the book, the author offers a fascinating insight into Trump's tweets and how they capture the news cycle invariably. The media barely has time to react. The op-ed writers fulminate. The magazines write long think pieces. Everyone is aghast or laughing or something. But by the time the outrage is just getting going, there's another tweet, and the previous outrage is forgotten and a new one ensues. This has the effect of creating an addictive narrative and a means of survival. Quote, if every new event canceled out every other event like some wacky news cycle pyramid scheme, then you always survived another day. This seems like a good description of the process of government in the age of Trump. Now here is the thesis of the book. The book does have a clean narrative theme throughout. The battle for Trump's soul between Steve Bannon and the First Family. The battle has been lost by Bannon, and this book throws the last bit of dirt on that grave. Wolff is highly astute about the difference between Reaganite liberalism and Bannonite revanchism. Quote, the essence of Bannonism and Mercerism, he writes, was a radical isolationism, a protean protectionism, and a determined Keynesianism. Now, let me just break this down, because this is why you listen to these podcasts, so we can really get into the nitty-gritty of this stuff. So this is Wolff, the author of the book, who is saying this. He writes, the essence of Bannonism was radical isolationism, protectionism, and determined Keynesianism, right? So this is very important to understand, because for where did the alt-right come from, for example? If you've heard about the alt-right, and you've heard probably a lot of criticism from myself in this podcast, because it is a departure, it is the, many of the arguments that I made during my presidential campaign last year were about the unprincipled populism in many ways, which is a complete disregarding of Reaganite liberalism. And some people will cringe, but when we say liberalism, we're talking about the real thing, not the fake liberalism of modern Democrats. We're talking about the Reaganite liberalism, which was not so heavily focused on isolationism, protectionism, anti-immigration, and then the Keynesianism, of course, which is how do you fund all these programs? Well, you have to have big government in order to protect industry, quote unquote, protect industry, and in order to build a wall that would be a step towards isolationism. And so what's interesting to me and to Jeffrey Tucker here is that the author, and this is really makes me want to read the book, is that the author appears to have a deep understanding of the departure of the sort of progressive populism from the Reaganite liberalism, which is much more closely related to what I believe in. I come much more from the Ronald Reagan, Ron Paul, Barry Goldwater wing of the Republican Party, whereas the modern iteration of that are probably best embodied by people like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, the true constitutional conservatives, right? But they don't have a lot in common with the isolationism, the nationalism, protectionism, and Keynesianism. Keynesianism is the philosophy of the School of Economics of John Maynard Keynes, right? It's the bailout mentality. It's the stimulus mentality, right? It is the big government school of economics. It's market socialism, right? You have some aspects of a market economy, some aspects of a socialist economy. And many in the alt-right were the sort of the ground movement, the base of people who have been pushing these ideas in the last few years. And their movement actually started to recede more before Bannon was ousted, which was just recently ousted from Trump's favor. And what's so interesting is that the administration, the Trump administration, has started to embrace more of the Reaganite liberalism and far less of the sort of Bannonite revanchism. Let me pull that up, because I want to make sure that I define this. When I say what revanchism is, I want to make sure you understand what this is. It's a policy of seeking to retaliate, especially to recover lost territory. Right. So it's the idea of when Tucker is saying that Bannonite is revanchism, right? It's the idea of make America great again, in the sense that America was better in the 1950s, right? So we need to go back to this idea of going back to this sort of protecting our culture in a sense. And how do we do this? Well, we do this through big government. And true constitutional conservatives, true libertarians, true conservatives, they understand that it's not the government's job to protect culture, quote unquote, right? Because culture is something that's determined by society. America is multicultural, whether you like it or not, right? California is just different from Missouri. California is different from Florida, right? And it's different from New York. Even though California and New York are both are mostly governed by different branches of democratic socialism in many regards, or democratic socialists who are governing them, those states. They're different forms, right? Whereas New York is much more of an imperial style of democratic socialism. The democratic socialism of California is much more the type of democratic socialism that is like the sort of paternalism, right? It's the nanny state, the helicopter parents, right? That's why they had outbreaks of malaria outbreaks there's some other I guess what I'm trying to say is that the sort of backwards leftist thinking of Californians are the crunchy granola types, right? Much less, they're completely different from the sort of suit and tie, pinstripe suit and tie, Mercedes Marxists of New York City, where they're much more the sort of petty tyrannical, like recycle or we'll charge you $150. Not that they don't do that in New York, but it's much more that sort of hippie leftism, the more Bernie bro style of leftism, whereas New York is more the Hillary Clinton style of corporatism. And these are two completely different types of cultures, even though they're of the same movement. And then, of course, in Missouri, if you look at it from a conservative viewpoint, the cultural conservatism of Missouri is much different than the cultural conservatism of Florida or of Alabama. Perfect example. So Alabama really does, in many ways, embody it's much closer to the sort of the Bannonite school of revanchism, right, of that old style of conservatism. Whereas in Kentucky and Missouri, we're much more moderate and we're much closer to the sort of Reaganite style of liberalism. Again, not the bad liberalism, the good liberalism, right? The freedom liberal type of liberalism. Maybe there's something about just being in the Midwest, the Midwest region, that tends to make Missourians a little less militaristic, or with the type of conservatism that we are. Much more front porch, much more like sitting on the front porch, relaxing with a glass of tea and thinking things over, much less, hot-headed, more of a sit-back-and-think style of conservatism that exists out here in the Midwest versus, culturally, we're very similar, right? Alabama and Missouri have a lot in common, and there's a lot of overlap there. But the thing is that this whole segue that I'm taking is to explain to you and help you understand how culture can be the same, right? The United States, we're all part of the United States, but we're multicultural in the sense that we have bastions of liberalism, we have bastionisms of conservatism, and we have a multicultural society in many ways, right? We have multiple types of religion and we have religious freedom. So of course that's going to grow up in here in the United States. And don't think that there isn't religious intolerance from the left, because there really is. It's what's interesting about the left is that they preach this message of tolerance. But then, of course, when you see the types of religions that they clearly favor, right, they have their own favorite. Like, they hate Christianity, for example. Many of the people on the left, they scorn it and they look down on it, but they lift up Islam, for example. And then, of course, on the right, you have people who they're endeared to Christianity, but of course they won't look at Islam through an objective lens. I'm not saying all, because again, I don't place all of the religions in the same boat and say, hey, they're all the same when it comes to what they mean. mean in terms of a modern cultural context. I think that there's something to, if you're really going to be objective, you do look at everything and say what objectively is better, at least in terms of a Western society lens, in terms of a true liberalist lens, in terms of a true individualist lens, because I believe that the what really makes America great is the concept of individualism. And in the larger sense, we can talk about microculture and macroculture, but on a macroculture scale, what really makes America great is our freedom. It is the individualism that is at the heart of the American experiment. So when neoconservative policymakers talk about America as being exceptional, right, to them that is a manifestation of the more imperial branch of the conservative movement, where they want to make America the world safe for democracy, right? It involves hardcore interventions, government interventions overseas, and eventually it leads to big government. I think true American exceptionalism should be centered around the concept of individualism and of liberty and of freedom. And how we get there, of course, is how we disagree. But that was quite a segue. But you know what? It's a podcast, and that's why you guys come here. So let's get back to the main big piece. Okay? The stunning split with Bannon has been beautiful to watch. Bannon was his strongest connection to fascist ideology, and it is possible that this break with Bannon, and remember, this is Jeffrey Tucker's words, not mine, that this break with Bannon will drive Trump to upend the aspects of Trumpism that Bannon had created and cultivated. What remains is a kind of chaos. Let's hope it is manageable enough to keep the world from going up in flames. Okay, now let me tangent here a little bit and say, Jeffrey Tucker here says that Bannon was Trump's strongest connection to fascist ideology. Well, of course, it depends, right? Because Bannon really was a hero to the alt-right. And a lot of the alt-right, the sort of logical conclusion of the ideology of the alt-right was fascism. And I don't say that lightly, because I know what an actual... I'm not like the left or social democrats where I don't know what a fascist is, right? But the alt-right, many of the movement... Again, I'm an internet warrior, right? I have a large internet presence. I participate in discussions online with people I know. The ideology, right? It is a form of nationalistic statism that many in the alt-right had embraced, which is why they weren't pro-life, right? Because they wanted to protect white babies, right? And they were like, okay, well, we have no problem with abortion in the inner cities, blah, 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 which is why the alt-right in many ways were eugenics. They were eugenicists. And they also, like Richard Spencer, who was one of the leaders of the alt-right, they were proudly and openly for socialized medicine, right? And so that shows you right there that the sort of the Bannonite school of thought, that sort of really hardcore nationalistic socialism, Keynesianism, remember we're talking about Keynesianism, and in this book he's talking about how Bannon was very much a Keynesian in many ways, that's being pushed to the side, and it's all for the better in many ways, because no matter what you think of President Trump or his White House, if you're a constitutional conservative, if you're a libertarian or a true conservative, getting tax cuts, getting deregulations, those kinds of things are the things that we want to see. And if Trump is the only guy who can be the bull in the china shop and sort of destroy the political establishment such as it is, well, this is the world we live in. It's Trump's world and we're living in it. And I'm not going to look a gift media mogul in the face and president in the face and say, oh no, this isn't good enough for me. I saw somebody posting an article the other day that says the libertarians should never should stop defending Trump. And when you're wrong, you're wrong. You got to admit it. And I didn't think that President Trump would be what he has become. And so in many ways, I was wrong. And most people aren't, they don't have the guts to admit that. But here's the thing. He's not supporting me in this primary race. He's supporting Josh Hawley. So it's not like I have some, I have to protect the president here. I'm saying that I seriously think that a lot of what President Trump has done in his first year in office is incredible, and I'd like to see more of it. But of course, what is to come remains to be seen, because it's so chaotic, it's difficult to determine. But what we know from the pushing out of Bannon and of the demotion of some of those sort of dark populist ideas, the darker side of populism, and again, a reason why a lot of the like Breitbart people and a lot of the populists like me is because there are some libertarian instincts within the modern populist movement, but it's coupled in many ways with a sort of strong, anti-liberty nativist stench that is in a lot of ways in danger now. And I think it's a good thing, because I think what it leads to, which is ultimately what I want to talk about today, is how this could spur the true principled libertarian conservative alliance, which is something that, you know, Ben Shapiro and I have been talking about recently, and something I'd like to promote, something that I think needs to happen, especially because now it's 2018, it's election year. We have a lot of work to do. And again, I'm going to give you a nice long podcast here. So let's get into the real nitty gritty. So let me get back to the point, and then I'll keep giving you guys my rants as we get to new good information here. So Jeffrey Tucker goes on to write, usually the new president is socialized to become, quote, presidential, because he is suddenly and overwhelmingly surrounded by courtiers, pleasers, servants, policy experts, lifetime bureaucrats, tasks, meetings, briefings, and so on. Trump was different. For him, the lifestyle of the White House, which he considers to be something of a dump, was a downgrade from all that has come from before. This accounts for why the presidency hasn't changed him. In one of so many anecdotes that humanize Trump, it is revealed that the president prefers to eat McDonald's because he has long feared a poisoning plot. He figures that McDonald's would not expect him to show up, and so no one would know to prepare a special poison meal. This is not unreasonable as I think about it. Similarly, Trump will not permit the White House maids to move a single article of clothing in his bedroom, nor change his sheets without his specific request. Again, this reflects a not unreasonable paranoia he has. This is both a reason for and a product of the kind of life he has lived. Inside a bubble, always feeling under fire, feeling like an underappreciated great man, certain that he and he alone can save himself from the vicissitudes of a crazy world. All that said, he desperately wants to be like, they're coming for me, guys. This is what I get for telling the truth in my podcast. No, this is actually just what I get for living right next to ambulance and firehouse. So there you go. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Trump says he desperately wants to be liked, and it is this which accounts for his stunning level of political malleability. How malleable? There was a moment during the transition that he began to change his mind on immigration. He had met top tech executives during the transition, a scene set up for him by his son-in-law. He became very concerned, and this may be why there was a lot of tension between Bannon and Kushner. He became very concerned that these companies do not have all the H-1B visas they need for new employees. Trump pledged to help them, thereby causing his then-Bannonite inner circle to guffaw that such a stance would be completely inconsistent with basically everything he said in his campaign. Trump didn't care. He came to enjoy the struggle between his confidants and visitors over his mind and heart, and trusted only himself to make the final decision. Meanwhile, every faction would get a day in the sun. Inauguration Day was the apotheosis of Bannon. The book confirms what I had only suspected. This is, again, Jeffrey Tucker's words. Bannon wrote the inaugural address. It was a dark, chilling, fascistic, statist, grim, and frightening flurry of right Hegelian blather. Now, these are a lot of big words here, guys. It made a god of the nation state and its chief executive. It contained not one word of Reaganite optimism. So let me go through this. Dark, chilling, fascistic, statist, grim, and a frightening flurry of right Hegelian blather. Now, what is Jeffrey Tucker saying about this? Now, Hegelianism, and I won't get into it very deeply. I'll give you a brief little explanation here. It's the philosophy of a G.W.F. Hegel, which is basically summed up that the rational alone is real, and his goal was to reduce reality to a more synthetic unity within the system of absolute idealism. So essentially, it's mostly used. It's a way of shaping thinking, and it's mostly used by the left. It's a left-wing tactic, right, is to have a Hegelian dialectic, which I would strongly, I'm teaching to the A students now, I know this, but if you're really interested in diving into the sort of concept of Hegel, you need to look up the Hegelian dialectic, which is generally a Marxist theory. But what was interesting was that what Jeffrey Tucker has noted here is that that was part, again, when I went back to, let's go back to what I said, to the Keynesianism that Wolf finds in his book that comes from the Bannonite school of thinking, right, the sort of nationalist populist movement. is very much of that sort of Marxist school in many ways. There's a lot of overlap. Again, why did the alt-right go pro-choice or instead of pro-life? Why did the alt-right support socialized medicine? Again, you know, the sort of it's a nationalist socialism versus the type of democratic socialism that we have. It's the socialism of the right, the hardcore progressivism in a sense of the right. It made a god of the nation state and its chief executive, and it didn't, this is Trump's speech, it didn't contain Reaganite optimism, right? The truth is that Trump could not sustain this nonsense. In his heart, he is a salesman, a business, a promoter, and not a prophet of doom. It seems clear in retrospect, that Bannonistic ideology could not survive in the mind of a man addicted to television and the culture of mass media. One of the best features of the book is the verbatim quotes from his speeches, which somehow blend stream of consciousness with humor and nonsense. Still, they invite you to take away some theme of some sort. In a strange way, too, they are endearing, like listening to a fun drunk guy at the bar who has a knack for last call entertainment. You like him, even though he makes no sense. The big change in the first 100 days, from right-wing agitator to tax cutter and deregulator, was orchestrated by Jared Kushner. His idea was to organize a meeting with CEOs from around to talk about business and economics, which is a much more natural fit for Trump than Bannonite bluster. It was this meeting that began the process of driving Trump toward a more constructive approach than ethnocentricity and wall building. It was the best meeting and moment in the first weeks of the presidency. Trump was engaged, curious, fascinated, and intelligent. He was in his element. It was also the first time he felt fully comfortable in his role. This was a pivotal moment when the demands of enterprise began to displace the weirdness of the early campaign rhetoric, right? In a very real sense, the merchant class might have saved this presidency. Now, this is where I get really excited, ladies and gentlemen. This is where I want to impress upon you, the listener, to understand where I'm coming from when I tell you that what I'm excited. People are like, Austin, why are you like seemingly doing 180? Like the Reagan Battalion and like the National Review, they all these people, they came after me like, oh, you're a Bannonite now, Austin, because you support Trump and you say this. I'm like, no, you don't understand that when, and I didn't realize it was Jared Kushner that pushed for this meeting, but you don't understand that Trump is going to, he's going from right-wing agitator to tax cutter and deregulator. That is amazing. Like, I want to be wrong. I want the president to do more of this. I want him to be having more of these talks and talking intelligently about business. And you have to understand where I'm coming from. I am a man of deeply held convictions and of principles. Cutting taxes and deregulation are an enormous part of that. And I hope you can tell from the passion, the emphatic tone that I'm using in this podcast right now that I'm being deeply sincere about how important these things are and why it is a good thing. And we work with what we have, right? We've got President Trump, and sure as hell, we would not have had this from Hillary Clinton, right? It would have been maintained the establishment status quo. And Trump is destroying that in many ways, and he's really earned my respect. And that's exciting because, you know, it takes a lot to earn my respect. I very, very rarely say nice things about politicians, except for the very few, which I do believe are on the right track in many ways. Moving on, and I'm loving this. So hope you're enjoying this because this when I read this article today blew my mind, and my mind has been racing since I read it. I hope you like this. If you're liking this podcast, don't forget you can subscribe on iTunes. You can subscribe to me on Stitcher. Also, it gets posted up on SoundCloud and lots of different places. I'm pretty sure Jeffrey Tucker shares it on Liberty.me as well. Anyways, but if you're listening, Jeff Tucker, fantastic piece, well written. Let's get back to your piece. Why hasn't Trump hired people to fill the bureaucracies? Wolf reports the main theory from the inner circle. Trump only thinks about what is happening around him or what he sees on TV. The bureaucracy is a distant abstraction. He cannot be made to care about it. This is not exactly how anyone would have predicted things would unfold. It wasn't long into the presidency, which he expected would soften the attacks from him, when he realized that his troubles had only just begun. He concluded that the entire system, media, bureaucracy, political mavens, lobbyists, were rigged against him. He came into office thinking that he would finally be liked. Instead, he dealt with nonstop trouble. It was this turn that led him to fight against what he considered to be the system, culminating in tax cuts and deregulation in defiance of everything official Washington is structured to prevent. Let me read that again because this is so important. He dealt with nonstop trouble. It was this turn that led him to fight against what he considered to be the system, culminating in tax cuts and deregulation in defiance of everything official Washington is structured to prevent. And I have been saying this for years, that the real machine, the regime, is in Washington, D.C., the establishment is all about protecting the bounty, that gets handed out to the lobbyists and to the corporations that through corporate welfare. It was everything that Trump has done with tax cuts and deregulation in many ways, it's against their interests, right? It's anti-protectionism in many ways, right? A lot of these companies now, they don't have the same sort of relationship, the special relationship with the president that they could have had in another thing. I mean, President Trump in some ways, he's at war with Amazon in many ways, right? Like, I love Amazon, but in some ways sort of being adversarial, with some of these institutions, it's weakened the sort of the institutions that libertarians and conservatives have been trying to weaken for years, right? It took the bomb thrower to destroy the sort of respected opinion that, like, what Tom Woods, if you're a Tom Woods guy, what Tom Woods has been saying has been the 3x5 note card of acceptable opinion in Washington, D.C., which is that we will have Keynesianism, we will have stimulus and bailouts, we will have big government, and the president will be respectable because he will ensure that the $2.5 to $3 trillion of revenue that comes in from taxpayers every year will be doled out to the appropriate sources, and we're not going to have tax cuts because that would clamp down on the revenue stream. It's an exciting time to live in right now. Love him or hate him, you know, you can't ignore him because, again, he's changing the way things are done, and I find that exciting. Moving on to Trump, Jeff's piece. Jeff says, so much of Trump's mood is determined by his surroundings. Bannon's description of the White House strikes me. It is not a mansion. It only has a facade and a few fancy rooms. It is actually a military base under military command and completely government issued. Trump can't stand the place. There is indeed not much about Washington that he likes at all. That's amazing. I mean, again, another paragraph that I'm reading here with glee as Jeff is describing this in the book. And again, now I feel like I absolutely have to read it. Is that Trump doesn't like being in the White House, right? He doesn't like the idea of being in a military base. You know, again, frankly, for those of you who knew last year, like, same here. Like, I wouldn't like to live in that kind of environment either. And Trump can't stand the place, right? Of course, because he's moving from Trump Tower to Washington to the White House, right? I mean, why would you want to downgrade in such a way? I mean, fascinating stuff. And honestly, the kind of real populist attitude in many ways that we want in a president, like somebody who doesn't want the job in many respects, right? The whole big narrative in the past week in the mainstream media is that he didn't even want to be president. And I'm like, good. As a matter of fact, I probably need to tweet something like that. Trump never wanted to be president. To be president, that's good. That's the sign that we like. That's that Washingtonian idea, right? And moving on back to Jeffrey's piece. Sorry, I get so excited. And what happened to the repeal of Obamacare? Wolf does a superb job explaining the health insurance problem that greeted the new administration. Trump loved the cheers he received in the campaign when he denounced Obamacare. But when it came to actually repealing it, Trump pulled back, favoring the core principles of Obamacare: universal coverage, no exclusion for pre-existing conditions, rather than a free market approach. The repeal and replace efforts never got through the underlying problem that the president wasn't really a believer. As I say, the central drama of the book concerns the battle between the brooding fascistic fanaticism of Steve Bannon, remember Jeffrey Tucker's words, and the prowess of the instinctual marketing genius Donald Trump. Bannon was deadly serious and came to believe his own winds of history rhetoric about the nation, state, and race. When Trump came to realize that Bannon is a Hegelian ideologue, not Trump's words, of course, and not at all practical, he drove him out. And thus the book does end with Bannon's own phantasmagorical illusions that he, Bannon, will someday be president. Interesting. Trump, of course, has been fulminating against this book. Jeffrey Tucker thinks this is a mistake. The book is credible and beautifully written, Trump, again, Jeffrey says, and even if we can't know for certain how much reflects the opinion of his sources versus how much is real. Regardless, what you come away with from this account is more sympathy than you might have ever had for Trump as a dazzling, strange, quasi-genius, accidental colossus bestriding the culture of our times as no one else could possibly do. Will he continue to play a much welcome disruptive role, bringing chaos and disruption where there has been mostly regimented order in the post-war period? Now, I would love to continue on with this, but again, we got to talk about that, what Tucker is saying. Will he continue to play a much welcome disruptive role, bringing chaos and disruption where there has been mostly regimented order in the post-war period? See, right, of course, after World War II, just like they did in the UK, the United States economy became heavily socialized, right? We had the New Deal that was being implemented at the time, right? And after World War II was over, this happened in the UK, and then we can relate it to the United States in just a second. But there was Winston Churchill lost his election, even though he was a war hero at the time, because the citizens of the United Kingdom were like, we didn't go and fight in Europe so that we could come back and have to work for ourselves. We want nationalized medicine, and that's how you get the National Health Care Service, right? And that's how you get the socialization of Britain's economy began in earnest. And it had begun here in the United States too, but it began to really ramp up with the rise of the Great Society and Lyndon Johnson and the welfare programs and the big government that we have in the United States today. But in order to destroy that, in order to turn that around, in order to push against the tides of democratic socialism and nationalistic socialism, we have to return. We have to disrupt. We have to bring chaos. We have to have, instead of the sort of regimented order that has been foisted on us by the socialists, whether nationalist or progressive or nationalist or democratic, we have to destroy that order, that system of order that they have placed, the regimentation that they have. Now, a lot of people balk at that because they get nervous when they hear that someone is bringing discord and chaos, right? But what Trump is doing in many ways is bring that sort of discord that was required, that is necessary. As a matter of fact, I just a few hours ago posted a tweet because I was inspired by this article where I was talking about, this is what I said. Respectable opinion in Washington for so long has been to maintain the status quo of regulations, taxes, and big government. Trump lifting up the rocks and shining a light on some of these swamp creatures has the predictable result of seeing them scurry and scream. Good. Now, that's my made-for-consumption sort of general view, but at the basis of this, is the concept of the liberty economic policies, the libertarian economic policies, which I embody, the Austrian School of Economics, which is embodied by a philosopher by the name of Friedrich Hayek. Friedrich Hayek had a theory of order, of spontaneous order, right? If you like the idea of order, right? And a lot of conservatives sometimes are law and order, right? And this regimentation, we need to, like, things. I just saw today that there was a senator or a Congress candidate in Texas who says we need regimentation, we need a military draft, right? That's that lust to control and for power, right? We must have an ordered society. But the true liberty idea is the concept of not a disordered society, but a society where order is achieved through mutual consent. That it's not like it was once famously said, it's not that there's no plans, it's that there are more planners. And that's the ultimate goal of people like myself, is to have a decentralized system where the states can decide, where we have federalism, where we have local governance and politics, where Washington, D.C. doesn't control everything, where we don't have all these bureaucracies like the Department of Education and the FDA and the USDA and all of these major institutions telling us what to do and how to live and what the size of our shoe leather should be. That's what we want. That is in totem the concept of spontaneous order. And that is an actual economic theory that was mostly brought about by the Austrian economists, by people like Karl Menger, people like Ludwig von Mises, people like Friedrich Hayek. Interestingly enough, if you're talking about history, it's believed, at least it was postulated by Murray Rothbard, that the first person to work out the ideas, it's actually an ancient thought, the ancient ideas, the first person to work out the idea of spontaneous order was perhaps a philosopher by the name of I can't pronounce it, obviously, I don't speak Chinese. Zhuang Zi, way back in 369 BC. And the philosopher rejected the authoritarianism of Confucianism, writing that, quote, there has been such a thing as letting mankind alone. There has never been such a thing as governing mankind with success. Right. So he articulated an early form of spontaneous order, asserting that, quote, good order results spontaneously when things are let alone, a concept later developed particularly by a philosopher named Proudhon in the 19th century. The thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, and this is a very, very fascinating time in history, would encourage all conservatives and libertarians to learn more about the Scottish Enlightenment. The thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment were the first to seriously develop and inquire into the idea of the market as a spontaneous order. In 1767, the sociologist and historian Adam Ferguson described the phenomenon of spontaneous order in society as a result of human action, but not the execution of any human design, right? So that's the idea. That's the heart and soul of what we believe, that humans, individuals, when left to their own devices, when they are not hyper-regulated, hyper-taxed, will make the best decision for themselves and for the people in their communities. So now I've been teaching to the A students for a while. Let's get back to the sort of general idea of what this means for my personal race, right? So what's interesting is that in lines of philosophy, right, Josh Hawley, my Republican primary competitor, has very much fashioned himself as sort of a Teddy Roosevelt-style Republican, which is interesting because, of course, what was great about Teddy Roosevelt were not his policies, but him as the man, sort of as him as the war hero, his battles like, you know, the Battle of San Juan Hill, right? And him as a great outdoorsman, which Josh Hawley really doesn't embody, right? Josh Hawley is an Ivy League educated lawyer who became a constitutional law professor and got lucky in his associations and joined all the right clubs and societies in order for him to get to where he's considered the favorite in this race. But in many ways, he's weak because what Josh Hawley is fashioning himself, why he's fashioning himself as a Teddy Roosevelt Republican is very much because of the progressivism that, in terms of economics, that Josh Hawley is embracing. It's more in line with Bannonism, right? And it's more in line with the nationalist populist style of school of economics, not related to the Austrian school of economics, the free market school of economics, the Reagan school of economics. That's where I live. That's where my people are. That's where I come from. That's my thinking. So it's very interesting, of course, too, because in terms of getting to the personality politics of this, is that Josh Hawley went and sought Steve Bannon's endorsement and worked very hard to make it so that he would have that faction of the Republican Party tied up. Now, to give Josh credit, the president himself said very many nice things, but the president's not an ideologue in many ways. Bannon was an ideologue, or it still is an ideologue. The Kansas City Star actually contacted me for comment on this the other day. To ask about, you know, Josh Hawley not saying anything about, Trump throwing Bannon under the bus. And I think, of course, it shows a lack of backbone on Hawley's part. How is he going to take on Claire when he doesn't have the guts to even take on the people that are supposedly supporting him? Or, he doesn't have the sort of moral, his moral compass, unfortunately, seems to be out of whack. And the reason why I think that is because he's so beholden to his donors and the people who are bankrolling his campaign. And I wonder how on earth is Josh going to run this campaign when he has to do his job as attorney general and he has to campaign and he has to beat Claire and he doesn't seem to have the fire in the belly, but also he's weak on the economic positions. I detailed in a piece in the Springfield Newsleader here in Missouri, if you'd like to really get into the nitty-gritty of this stuff, you can look it up, where I said that Josh Hawley is taking Missouri voters for a ride with his investigation into Google because he was going after them potentially on antitrust, right, which is very much a Roosevelt kind of a thing. It's that populism that I won't call it conservative. I'll say it's a progressive republicanism that is out of line with what Trump is going towards, right? What Trump is going towards, the more Reaganite liberalism. He's going more towards the school of thought, of philosophy, the economics of liberty. And that is interesting because, you know, Hawley is very much out of step with that. Now, of course, Trump and Hawley, and so, they're not going to get into the details of all these kinds of things. It's my job as the only candidate in this race who is advancing a philosophy, who is advancing a set of principles, who is advancing ideas. It's my job, of course, to break this down for you all, for my loyal listeners, so that you can be more educated and you can be better activists for the cause of limited government and personal liberty and economic freedom and all the things that if you believe like I believe in freedom, then, of course, you know, this will make you a stronger champion of those ideas. Of course, they won't be getting into that, right? I strongly believe that the that of course this race will not hinge on those, you know, this sort of meta discussions. This is why I'm doing this podcast again, so we can have this. But what I strongly believe is that you should be informed, you the listener, you the voter, you the activist, or you know, even the critic should be informed as to what's at play here. Because the pushing out of Bannon means that the chance for what I believe could be a true libertarian conservative alliance in the 2018 elections is available now to us. Because now the nationalist populism is in retreat, right? The alt-right got creamed after Charlottesville. Bannon has been pushed, swept aside, at least for now. And now we have this opportunity. I think there's an opening. And I want to be the champion in Missouri of the principles of liberty, and I want to represent the citizens, all the citizens of my state, because ultimately, to go up against Claire McCaskill, she cannot paint me as some tool of Mitch McConnell or the establishment. You know, she can't paint me as being bought or paid or sold. You know, I'm not the politician she wants to run against. She doesn't want to run against me, that's for sure. Because I can hit her on those criminal justice issues where she's out of touch with her own base. And then, of course, I'll hit her on the issues where the Republicans will want to elect me for, because she voted against the tax bill. She's been she paints herself as a moderate, but she's been nothing but a party line Democrat. Hillary's best friend, Obama's best friend. Well, that's not a formula for winning the 2018 elections. And if I really wanted to get into the details with you all, what's interesting is that the real challenge is that you can't win a Republican primary without sort of being associated with Trump in many ways, right? But you can't win the general by going full alt-right, by going full sort of nationalist populism. You can't win a primary like that, right? We saw what happened with Roy Moore in Alabama. And in some ways, you know, Ed Gillespie in Virginia tried to adopt Trumpism in some ways, right? The sort of the ethno-nationalism. He tried to adopt some of that rhetoric, but it didn't serve him well. Ed Gillespie couldn't become the next governor of Virginia because it's not pleasing to a general audience. I think I'm the perfect candidate for Missouri because, like I said to the Kansas City Star the other day, I'm not about personalities. I'm about policies. You know, I stand where I've always stood. When Trump says he wants to cut spending, cut taxes, overturn Obamacare, get the federal government off our backs, pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, cut spending to the United Nations, you know, maybe even do what Rand Paul says and take the money we send to Pakistan and use that for the infrastructure projects rather than increase spending, I mean, I am 100% on board. Where do I depart with the president? Well, when he says nice things about Josh Hawley, I'm sorry, I've got to go another way. And maybe that's where I should leave it, guys. Thank you so much for listening to the Freedom Report podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all at the same name. It's AP for Liberty, AP4Liberty. AP for Liberty. Go to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Add me there. Learn more about what I believe in, why I should be the next senator from Missouri, why I think I would be a good representative of all Missourians, even the ones who don't end up voting for me in the event I win the general election against Claire McCaskill. I will be a good representative to all Missourians because I think that I have a good, broad platform that is appealing to all Americans. The liberty message unites us. It doesn't divide us, like Ron Paul once said. Again, thanks so much for listening, and you all have a fantastic week.